hope everyone's still awake and you all had your cookies. So I'm Jen Steele. I'm the CMO of Madison Logic, and I am here with three incredibly kick-ass women, and that's why we're a power panel here. So given the conversations we've already had, I think this is going to be super exciting, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves, starting with Sherry.
Hi, I'm Sherry Merzdorf. I'm the VP of marketing for eVariant. We sell a CRM solution just to hospital systems, which means I have roughly 300 accounts that I care about. So it's really fun.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lero. I'm the Vice President of Demand Generation at PTC. We're a Boston-headquartered large software company selling into the engineering and manufacturing space. I've been working in B2B tech marketing my whole career. First, I was on the PR side for about 12 years, working on the agency side and the corporate side. And then from there, I moved over. For the last 12 years, I've been on the demand gen side for a variety of companies, most recently PTC.
And my name is Brandy Smith. I am the VP of Demand Gen and Marketing for Uberflip, which is a content experience platform. I have a very similar background to you. So 18 years B2B tech marketing, and very much a generalist background. Started off in more like the PR and the corporate communications, and then eventually just found myself in demand generation over the last, I'd say, about 7 years.
Great. Thanks. So why don't we get this started with something exciting? So what's the most exciting demand gen or ABM thing that you or your team are working on? And pretend I can talk.
Yeah. So I would say probably for us right now, there's two things. One, I am like fairly obsessed with us redoing our website. Finally, it's only been like 3 years. And so we're really focused on what's going to help us convert and adding personalization into that. So we've been using personalization for the last couple of years, but now we're really trying to think differently about how we integrate that into like our overall mix and what else we're doing, rather than it being kind of random acts of personalization. And then the other thing is we're really hitting our stride. So I mentioned we have 3 accounts. They all really matter. You would think that we would be really lockstep with sales, but we're really turning a corner in that relationship right now, where they're proactively coming to us, asking us to help with their key accounts, which is different than us trying to like pull them into what we're doing. And so we have some really exciting things that we're starting to think about and brainstorm on how we're going to really engage some of those accounts with some really interesting, very targeted activities.
Cool. Brandy, I don't like going straight down the line. So Brandy?
I would have to say that we are really, you know, we've been doing ABM for about a year, year and a half, but, you know, I like to say we've been doing some cute campaigns, right? So what we're doing now is really placing a lot of heavy emphasis on transitioning to more of a blended ABM strategy. You know, we have one-to-one, one-to-few, and one-to-many, and really kind of focusing across all three and having team members focus on individual ABM strategies. But, you know, we still kind of do the demand gen stuff in the background, right? I mean, ultimately, ABM is the future, especially if you want to land those whale accounts, but we still have to have the traditional demand gen in the background, because ultimately, we're trying to create a whole new category, the content experience. But eventually, we are making the shift more and more and more to ABM, because, you know, ITSMA, and there's data out there that really demonstrates that ABM is the wave of the future, simply because it is really around targeting those large enterprise accounts and really what's going to be generating pipeline more so than traditional demand.
Great. So I have a slightly different area to talk about, and that's augmented reality. So PTC, one of the areas that we're in the technology space is augmented reality. So we've been trying to incorporate it into our marketing for obvious reasons. So one of the projects we recently did, PTC has a very big partnership with Rockwell Automation, and I see Paula in the audience here who heads marketing for Rockwell Automation. So one of the things that we did is we wanted to take a really creative and different approach. So we partnered up with the National Association of Manufacturers, PTC and Rockwell and the National Association of Manufacturers, and we put together a comic book that was augmented reality enabled. So you could download an app on your phone, you point it at the comic book, and the comic book comes to life. Now, the audience for this We were trying to encourage students to get interested in careers in manufacturing and showing them how there's so much new cool technology out there in manufacturing and you should pursue a career in manufacturing. That was the initial audience, but this thing really took on a life of its own. We give these things out at trade shows. People download it from the website. It's really, the engagement is really, really high. People just love playing around with it. They like the comic book aspect. They like the augmented reality aspect. And it's really been a great traffic driver for us.
If we didn't have the rest of the conversation to go, I would actually go download it now.
I'm happy to send the link out to anybody that wants it.
That's wicked cool. Yeah. Awesome. So last night I was actually having a conversation with a few people about how LinkedIn is dying. Right, so it's like, oh, what's the spam connection request today? And LinkedIn, which had been a really effective demand gen channel, seems to be dying. So I guess let's kind of play a hot or not. What are your hot and cold channels, Michelle?
All right, hot or not. So LinkedIn, I would have to somewhat agree. And I think what it is when LinkedIn... trying to remember the InMail and the Sales Navigator products, et cetera, first came out, not a lot of companies were using it. So I think initially people got really excited because they were getting really good response rates, but then word caught on that it was working really well. So the effectiveness. And I mean, we went through the same thing with direct mail. Direct mail got saturated, people stopped doing it, and then all of a sudden there was a resurgence in direct mail because it was so unusual to get something in the mail again. I think channels kind of come in and out based on the usage of them to some degree. But one channel that does appear to truly be dying is outbound email. Not all email, but outbound email. Trigger-based email, behavioral-based email, nurture streams that people have opted into, that's all working fine. But just the pure outbound email push, the rates are really dropping off a cliff. Particularly about a year ago, Outlook, Microsoft 365 Outlook introduced a new feature that really just pushes all those emails into a different inbox. And almost overnight, those outbound email rates just started plummeting, and I don't see that coming back.
Anyone else? Hot or not? What's working?
I would have to agree with literally everything. That sounds like almost a cop-out, but I would have to agree completely. But it also really depends in my mind. I mean, having worked with various tech organizations and having, you know, marketed to different audiences, I think sometimes it really depends on the business and what your product and service is and who you're actually marketing to as well, right? So we market to marketers. How, you know, for us, it's very different in the way that we market and engage with our audience versus if we were, you know, marketing to engineers, as an example. Engineers will probably prefer more complex documentation like a white paper, whereas marketers, they want really fun, cool, quick snippets of information like videos or blogs or something like that. Or, you know, snack-sized ebooks with a lot of really great research and findings that help drive and optimize your own internal results.
I agree that mostly LinkedIn is dying from an outbound push perspective, but it's still where we get the most engagement from just like our community is still them engaging with our posts. So I think as long as you're doing it kind of in the same way that you do the triggered, then it's not dying, it's not going away, but the spamming approach is it's not working.
So it sounds like channels work until marketers kill them.
Sounds like
until it's oversaturated.
Until bad marketers kill them.
Oh, sorry. None of the marketers in this room are killing any channels, clearly. Clearly. Okay, so channels aren't complete without content. So, Brandy, can you talk a bit, since that's what you guys do, can you talk a bit about what works and what doesn't?
Again, I think it goes back to, you know, your business and who you market to. Ultimately, that's going to steer kind of your content strategy and your content direction, right? I mean, it's all about who your audience is. For us at Uberflip, you know, sorry, Jen, I'm going to get you to repeat the question because I had another question in my mind that we had in our panel, and I think I'm actually going down that road. it's been a long day.
The first part of this three-part question is what works and what doesn't from a content perspective.
Yeah.
Anytime.
So yeah, I think it really just depends on your audience, right? So again, like we market to marketers and we're actually finding that, again, those snack-sized pieces of information is what's exciting our audience. And we have to be really, really creative. We have to like think of things outside of the box and like constantly push the envelope in terms of what we're doing and what we're putting out there to actually engage them and get them to pay attention.
So one of the concepts that we use for a lot of our content, I call it show, don't tell, right? People like to tell people things, but don't tell them show them. And an example of this, we recently did some experimentation with Facebook live stream. So one of the products that we sell is CAD software, computer aided design software. You wouldn't think that's exciting. It's been around for 35 years. People can design anything. They can design a car, they can design this chair, they can design this microphone. But what we did with Facebook is we have this huge user community, going back to the user communities, and we said, what can we do with this as a channel? What kind of content can we put out there that's going to draw people in? So what we did is we went to one of our user groups, we found a team of super advanced power users of our CAD software, and we said, will you go on Facebook and just build something live? Like, we'll go live and you say, I'm going to build an X. And you go up there and you just start designing it live. And we got huge audiences for this. People like to watch other people. It's kind of like, I don't know if anyone here has teenagers. I have three teenage boys. They spend all, if they're not playing video games, they're watching other people play video games. And the concept is kind of the same. I mean, we were just amazed at the audience. People just want to see other people using the products to learn tips and tricks, or they're just fascinated by watching what other people can do. And that was sort of a new content form for us that was unexpectedly fairly successful. So we've repeated it, and then you have the recording, and then it lives on our Facebook channel. We get a lot more views after as well.
I now have this mental picture of a Facebook live video of building a marketing automation campaign, and I'm not sure I want to see it though.
I think you're right though. From a B2B perspective, we're actually starting to see significant uplift in what we're doing with Facebook. And we're actually getting more of our IAP interacting with our Facebook outreach. It's really quite interesting.
Really? Because I feel like Facebook's dying from a personal perspective. Like, it's not on my phone anymore.
I rarely interact with it too, but our IAP, marketers are on there. It's crazy.
Huh, that's funny. I almost feel like I don't even want to, I don't want to be on Facebook because I personally don't necessarily, we don't need to talk about it, but I don't necessarily agree with all the things they're doing. And so I don't want to spend effort enforcing that platform. And I guess that's a choice we get to make as marketers, right? Where we are going to support or not support, but yeah.
Rather than derail into an ethics conversation, yeah, which I am dying to do, I will admit. So we talked about, how do you shape content to an audience? Do you use intent data? Do you use the spaghetti test and throw stuff at a wall and see what sticks? How do you figure it out?
So I'll go. So I mentioned earlier that we've been using personalization for a little bit on our site, and we actually go pretty deep in how much we tag our pages so that then we can understand what your favorite topic is and continue to kind of dive into whatever that thing might be. And then that's helping to inform what we're sending out from an email perspective and trying to personalize that a level deeper, or what we're suggesting that you do. So that's one of the ways that we're using. I forget even what the question was now, but
how do you
we're doing
figure
that.
Out what content. Oh, wait. How do you shape content to the audience?
So we do a lot of persona-based research. So a lot of what we do is sort of proactively looking at PTC being a large company. We have a lot of different product lines targeted at a lot of different personas. So to be honest, sometimes the complexity can go off the charts because you can have two different products that have the same buyer. And then we have to make sure that we're not hitting the same audience with three different campaigns at the same time. So we have to do a lot of negotiation of sort of which campaign we're going to run to which audience and when, using what content format. Like you mentioned engineers there. One of our audiences is engineers. And engineers in particular, they do like technical content, but they also like very visual content. So a lot of the campaigns that we do out toward engineers tend to have a lot more of a visual element because they're just geared that way. They design things all day. They like to look at images and pictures. But then some of the other audiences, one of the audiences we targeted is the head of professional services, for example, who are notoriously hard to reach because apparently they don't read anything, they don't open any emails, they're not on social media, and they go to one event a year. It's very much a word of mouth. So the way we have to approach that is very different, and the type of content we would use there would be very different than if we were targeting a CIO or an engineer or some other persona. So it's very much persona driven.
We actually leverage our own content experience framework. Yes. we drink our own Kool-Aid or drink our own champagne. So the content experience framework is literally to help guide you to create personalized content experiences throughout the entire buyer journey. So there's like a 5-step process to it, everything from like organizing your content to, you know, tagging and structuring your content, right? Like how you're actually going to feed it out to your audience and, you know, what does that tagging structure look like? So when they come in from a navigation standpoint, they can quickly and, you know, easily find what they're looking for. It could be by persona, you know, like you're doing, or it could be by, you know, industry, or it could be by topic, or it could be by, you know, marketing strategy, things like that. And ultimately, like you get down to the end goal where you're generating and understanding the results that you're driving from your content.
Yeah, we're actually, just to horn in on the conversation that I'm technically moderating, we're looking at intent data. We're looking to see like what our targets are looking at and saying, oh, they're going that way. I thought they were going this way, right? And that definitely shapes our efforts.
Yeah, I had another comment I wanted to add. You just made me think of it. So we have what we call the choose your own adventure for some of our campaigns. I mentioned we have, as a large company, like right now, we have over 32 different thematic campaigns running. So we have to be careful not to, you know, we have to be careful about who we're targeting with what and when. We have this notion of choose your own adventure. So if there's a topic that's appealing to a number of people, but then we want to take them down a more specific path, we let their content choices self-select them into what nurture path they're going to follow. So for example, we had a big article in Harvard Business Review. Our CEO wrote an article for Harvard Business Review, huge draw. We got 10,000 downloads of it. But then it was like, what next? How do we nurture the people that come in off of that? Because it was such a varied audience that came in. So we had 3 different paths. So when you came to download the article, we asked you a couple of questions. And depending on how you answered those questions, that sent you off into one of 3 different tracks. And then it went from there. So that's one of the other ways that we sort of, I wouldn't call it intent data in the way I tend to think of intent data, but we call it choose your own adventure as a euphemism for how we describe letting people choose their own path.
We should talk about self-nurture. But we're also starting to tap into intent data. So we partner with Bumbora. It's built into our platform. So our customers are actually able to leverage intent data to feed the AI engine. But, you know, we've just started using Madison Logic as an example for our ABM campaigns. So we're starting to monitor that so we can then get to a more personalized level of detail, right? So we're looking at ways of, we've also gotten Bumbora integrated with our Marketo instance. So now we're looking at ways that we can personalize our website based on their intent information and, you know, how we can drive more personalized nurture streams and things like that to them.
Okay, this is off script, but I have to ask, where do we draw the line as marketers between personalized and creepy? seriously, no, I always tell people like the internet's a creepy place. And as marketers, we can be so hyper personalized that it's like, go away. Like when Amazon first started doing it, I was like, I'm logging out now.
I'm kind of lucky because I market to marketers, right? And I think we, at the end of the day, understand that it's actually just a creepy level. And we as business-to-business buyers are also consumers. And we have all of these highly personalized experiences on our day-to-day interaction with things like Spotify or Netflix or whatever that may be. Like, we expect a very big level of personalization. I don't want to go to a company and get information fed to me that's completely irrelevant to my buying intent or to what I've looked at previously and whatnot. So I think me as a marketer, and again, I'm fortunate enough that I market to marketers, we actually expect it. But I think it can get to like that creepy level. And I would be curious to know, you know, how the engineers kind of deal with it or manufacturing.
So I was going to say, we also market to marketers are one of our key personas, but they actually still do find it really creepy. They're not quite there in understanding how some of this technology works. And if they come to my site and they've been to my site before and they filled out a form and I know who they are and I say, welcome back, Julie. Inevitably, I get some emails that are like, you can't use my name on the site or you can't use my organization. Like, we didn't authorize that. And I'm like, I'm actually not, only you saw that. So I still think it like very much depends on your audience and how comfortable they happen to be with it. Because even the marketers that I'm marketing to are sometimes not, but it's, at least in my case, they're getting there faster because we're teaching them that's the thing that they should they should be doing, but.
I think that's a really valid point because oftentimes we're marketing to tech marketers. So we understand the tech landscape. You know, we look at that chief marketer, you know, that big, giant, god-awful list of tech companies out there, and we're constantly evaluating and looking at it. So I think, again, I'm kind of lucky from that perspective, but healthcare marketers, yeah, definitely a very different breed.
Yeah, and as somebody who doesn't market to marketers, I can say, yeah, I think there's a very fine line. And when you start to get outside of North America, for example, obviously GDPR, things like that come into play. The sensitivity level, particularly in Europe, is much higher. People do not like to feel like they're being targeted. Even something that says, welcome back, Julie, you know, that would really, but even, you know, something like a demand-based ad that says, welcome back, PTC, sometimes can be off-putting. I do think it's a really fine line. And if you're marketing globally, you have to be really careful about that because different cultures have a very different tolerance level. Sometimes you can, if you do it in such a way, like I'll give you an example. We did a one-to-one ABM program for a large commercial airline. I won't say their name. We knew we were targeted. We had a little bit of personalization, but we had a whole series of blog posts that we wrote just for this one buying team at this one company. Now they didn't know we had written the blog post for them. We did put it on our blog and it was out there openly for anybody to read. And then we pre-wrote an email for the sales guy to send to them to say, hey, you were just sharing with me that you were having problem XYZ. We just wrote a great blog series on this. Here's the link. Now, the target did not know that we didn't expose the fact we've had webinars for one account. They don't know they think it's a webinar that we've done for a large crowd, and it's actually a webinar that we've done just for them. So sort of hiding the fact, ultra customizing the content, but hiding the fact that you've customized it is one of the ways that you can still take that super personalized approach without freaking people out.
I'm just trying to figure out if that makes you more or less creepy. We also market globally, and so I'm really careful with personalization as a result, because what might be appealing to the marketers I market to in North America is really going to be off-putting in other places. So moving along to, you've talked about blog posts and we've talked about content and channels, and it takes a village, right? All these engagement efforts take a village. So Michelle, you're at a larger company. What teams are actively involved in your engagement efforts, and how do you keep the ship going one direction?
Yeah, so we have a very large regional marketing team. We're in China, Japan, Korea, India, Italy, Germany, you name it, we're out there. So we have a very large team. We have what we call a central demand gen team, which is in our headquarters in Boston. That's the team that's creating the bulk of the campaign materials. We then get those materials out to the regional marketers, and then the regional marketers will take a look at that. We kit everything up, including social, not just standard campaign materials, but social media posts and other things like blog posts, et cetera. They'll take that and customize it. They'll look at the appropriateness for their region, and then they'll customize it. They'll put in local case studies, things like that. Also, the BDRs. We have a large team of BDRs. We call them our high velocity sales team, or HVS. They all have social media accounts. They've all been trained on social selling. Same thing. We kit materials up for them so that they, on a more of a one-to-one basis, they can be, after they've had a great conversation with somebody, they can say, "Hey, we're having a webinar next week. Let me send you an invite to that." And then we use. They're using SalesLoft as their tool to track all of that. So they're helping us, the sales team is helping us amplify on social, and then we have that large network of regional marketers that are also helping us get the word out globally.
But even smaller companies still have a lot of players.
Yeah, we do. My programs manager does like a weekly stand-up with literally every single one of our reps. Now, we're a small company. I have 5 new business reps and 6 account managers, but she's literally touching base with them every week, being like, did you see this account that we sent you? Did you see these people? Do you know about these campaigns that are coming? Are you just aware? So we do a lot of that, kind of just like really intense hand-holding that takes a lot of time. It can be a little painful, but now we're in a place again that the reps are coming to us. They feel a little bit more like we've indoctrinated them into our process, and we're proactive. Even even though we were going to include those accounts anyway, because we have 300 accounts, they feel like they're part of deciding these things now. And so that really matters. So we do that. And then we have kind of regular check-ins with some of our SMEs, because they're the ones out in the field, to give us guidance back on what are they hearing, how are conversations shifting, what should we be saying. And they're the ones that author a lot of the content that we're doing anyway.
So we're very similar to Sherry in terms of how we're, you know, attempting to align with sales. They need a lot of handholding, right? And even when it comes to like booking a meeting at a conference or an event, it's just like pulling hair, or pulling teeth. But, you know, on our team, it's really like a cross-functional marketing team effort, right? So we have our content experience team who's developing content and helping us, you know, really kind of guide what our strategy is going to look like from a content perspective. And then there's the demand gen team. We have a programs manager, marketing ops manager. We have ABM folks. We have field marketing, like, you know, product marketing. Like, all of these individuals play a fairly significant role when it comes to building out our programs, building out our content, building out our overall marketing strategy and go-to-market. It's truly like a massive team-wide effort.
See, this is where I get creepy, because I actually try to make sales feel like they've pulled the marketing in, right? So it becomes, I'm a little fortunate right now because, of course, we're an ABM platform and my whole sales team is, please use the platform, make it work. You're awesome. It's a great platform. Please, please, please. We need this stuff, right? That's a fantastic thing. Fantastic place to be in. But also just from a communication standpoint, like it just becomes, oh, so what do you want? And oh, here's this thing that is almost like that we'd already planned.
Well, and then having them really, to your point, very much a part of the process, Sherry, where, you know, it's working with them from an ABM perspective and helping them really identify who those accounts are and making sure that if it's their accounts, I mean, at the end of the day, they're truly bought into that process, right? So making them, again, feel like they're owning the process with you.
Yeah, one of the differences between this year and last year, just having now been doing these for four or five months, is like that they are pulling us in and that they feel like they're part of it. And conversely, we're now getting the intel that they already had from that conversation that they didn't put in Salesforce and didn't share with us in any other kind of manner. So we then are able to do things like hyper-customize our content because now they're telling us things, which did not happen before. Before it was like, why are you bothering me? I don't care about this thing that you did.
I've been known to tell sales that, oh, really, all ABM is? It's sales just with some marketing help. So we're here for you. You know, and of course, we named it. We're marketers. So, okay, we're starting to reach close to the end here. Sherry, what's the biggest lesson you've learned this last year?
So one of the things that I think that we didn't do a great job of last year is really mixing up our content. So I have a relatively small team. I have a programs person and a designer, and then I have three co-ops. And if you don't know what a co-op program is, it's basically a college student who's interning with you full-time for 6 months, and you pay them. And then at the end of that 6 months, they leave, and you start over. So that was its own kind of exercise in trying to get all of our processes aligned last year. And so now everything is so documented, it would make your head explode. And then when we change a process, it kind of changes it. But it makes it really hard to constantly kind of evolve the things you're doing because there's a base level of knowledge that you need to kind of build to the next level. And I lose that knowledge every six months. And my team is basically three other people. So one of the things I don't think we did very well last year is kind of changing what we were doing or changing the mix, the marketing mix that we were going to market with. And so we kind of just got really comfortable with webinars and scaled a bunch of webinars. And then we got to the end of the year and we were like, we did 80% more webinars, but we didn't get more hand raises. So I don't think we did a good job kind of mixing that up or continuing to measure along the way, which my bad.
So lessons learned, I would say I've been at PTC for 2 years, introduced the concept of account-based marketing to the company. They were doing some account-based advertising when I joined. There wasn't nothing going on, but it wasn't really the true ABM, the way that gets talked about at these conferences. Lesson learned for me is particularly in a larger organization, we're 6,500 people, you really have to persevere to sell an idea. There are literally hundreds of people that I have to get on board. It's been a very long process, but but we've been taking baby steps. You just have to keep going, keep going, keep going. I was talking to somebody earlier. I have the I Love ABM sticker on my laptop. I know David Meerman Scott showed all the... I have one sticker on my laptop, and I did it on purpose. I got it at this conference last year, and I got so excited. I stuck it on the back because every meeting I am in, various executives, other stakeholders say, oh, I love ABM. What's ABM? And it's my entrance into educating them onto what it is, why it works, why we really need it. And then, you know, we have literally salespeople into the thousands. So trying to get that many people all moving in the same direction for an ABM style program is really challenging. You have cultural issues, language issues, right? We've got people in China, India, Japan, et cetera. So what we did is we've been starting small. We've been starting with pilot programs, predominantly in North America, with very specialized sales teams to sell it as a concept. But it's one of those things that it big ideas take a long time to sell. How long did it take for the waterfall model to catch on? Like 10 years before now that became the standard way that people, you know, you can go to pretty much any exec team now and say that marketing is using this waterfall model. And most exec teams today know what that is. You don't have to explain it anymore. ABM is still in those early days. I think it's going to be another 4 or 5 years before it really becomes sort of a standard marketing methodology. But that's sort of lesson learned for me is you really have to just keep educating and persevering before you can sell a big idea.
I would have to agree with that. And even, you know, we've made a lot of changes over the last year. And part of that is also just, you know, not just from a marketing perspective, and it really is from a marketing perspective, but helping individuals and like board of director members understand that when you come in and you make a massive shift in terms of the way that you're doing your marketing performance management and the way that you're actually scoring leads and shifting those over to sales, it's like you have to continuously educate them that it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, and that new data actually takes time and that it's not going to be an overnight process where we're predicting what that funnel and that pipeline and that outcome is going to be in just 2 months, right? Like it's a constant education process. And I think we as marketers just have to do that overall in everything that we do.
Okay, I think we have like 2 minutes left. One quick takeaway, Brandy.
I'm going to go back to data, right? So as a demand genner, I mean, data is everything. If you have data, you have nothing. There's no way that you can predict your funnel. There's no way that you can predict your pipeline. There's no way that you can prove your value and your worth. There's no way that you can, you know, look at all of the different programs and channels that you're leveraging and utilizing and understand what's working versus not working and, you know, A/B testing and constantly optimizing what you're doing. Constantly tap into your data. Make sure your processes are set up to make sure that you are in fact successful when you look at that data and make those optimizations and those shifts.
I'm going to go a different direction. My one word is going to be mobile. We haven't talked about it here today, but it's constantly in the back of my mind. I mean, look, take a look at your web traffic data. More and more and more of it, people are coming in off of smartphones and tablets. The days of the laptop and obviously desktop computer, it's waning. So optimizing your programs, your content, your experiences for mobile devices is really going to become more and more important. And I think it's an area, particularly in B2B, that is very neglected.
I was also going to say data, but slightly differently, I think, in that really being very thoughtful about what the, you know, couple things that you really care about starting with and setting that standard. Because we rolled out the demand unit waterfall process just under a year ago. And I'm still in the same kind of boat where I'm like, no, guys, it takes time for me to be able to tell you what this means, but I can tell you what it means right now, but not that I can be predictive about it. But so picking just like the one or two things that you're going to really hammer home over and over again that you're picking on. But then somehow not forgetting about the rest of it so that I don't do too many webinars again.
And of course, my big takeaway is that we will always have jobs because we can't stick with anything because we'll kill it. No, I'm kidding. And my biggest one, though, is that the three of you have been fantastic. And thank you so much for joining me up here.
Thank you.
Thank you.